Good afternoon. I call the meeting of the Agriculture, Finance, and Policy Committee to order. Quorum is present. I do want to just state I'm happy to be in an open room rather than trapped in an elevator like I was yesterday for an hour with Representative Fisher. So elevator one in the Centennial Building, if you're just over there, might want to try another one. So it's great to be free. Is there someone to move the minutes? Representative Nelson, you want to move the minutes?
Yes, I will move the minutes from the, what day was that? Whatever Monday was, the March 2nd.
Representative Nelson moves the minutes for March 2nd. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say nay. The motion prevails. The minutes are approved. Members, we have two items of business today. The first one is a presentation on economic consolidation of agriculture. This will go from approximately 1 to 1:45. Austin Furick will be speaking, and then we'll have about half an hour for questions from the members. We're not taking any additional public testimony on the presentation. So with that, Mr. Furick, if you want to introduce yourself for the record.
Perfect. Thanks again for having me here today. I'm Austin Furick. I'm a seventh generation Iowan. I'm the first in my family to go to college. My dad's a truck driver. My mom's a home health aide. I went to Grinnell College in Madison, so don't get mad at me. And I'm based at Yale now. And so part of my talk today is based on my book I published almost 2 years ago called Barron's Money, Power, and the Corruption in America's Food System. Let me first start off by showing this blurb. My favorite view I've gotten for this book came from the American Conservative. And what I love about this topic, honestly, is how bipartisan it is. Everyone's seen the system not work for people. Farmers are being squeezed on both the input and output side. American consumers are paying more for lower quality products in the grocery store. And on top of it, a lot of these big ag conglomerates aren't even American at this point. So the way my book is structured is I profile 8 robber barons. And part of what I'm doing here is showing readers that we've been here before. And it's also, it's kind of like a, think of it as like a narrative device to tell structural stories. So you know, like when you give a dog a pill, you put it in cheese. That's what I'm doing here, is I'm telling you these stories of robber barons, but I'm telling you bigger structural stories. So before I dive into a few barons today, I want to show these first few slides. To me, this chart right here is a really good example of how one data set can tell you two different things. On the right is what the average person in these countries in 2023 spent on food. And you'll notice we spend more money on food per person than the United Kingdom, France, Japan, and we're about dollar for dollar with Italy. And anyone that's been to Italy knows what dollar gets you there is very different than a dollar here. What industry will tend to do to frame it in their ways, they'll say is percent of income. They'll say we spend the least amount of money of any country in the world. That's factually true. Here's the thing. Income has been captured by only a few, and that's a ratio. The bottom half of Americans have not experienced this income growth. What matters to them is what they spend at the register, and they're spending a lot. And when we talk about food, we tend to use national figures. And so check out the slide on the right. A friend of mine, he's a dairy guy in Wisconsin, did a paper a few years ago at Yale Law on how one company has an 85% market share in milk in New England, and I don't need a PhD in econ to know people there are not paying a fair price for milk. On your left is a chart from Bloomberg Law a few years ago where right before Thanksgiving, they documented every single protein in America, including salmon and tuna, were under investigation for price fixing. Here's the thing, we shouldn't be shocked. When markets are concentrated, they gouge. That's what they do. And then on top of it, a few weeks later, they published a story. Well, part of the story was every meat is under investigation except turkey. And then a few weeks later, turkey was under investigation. And I love showing this slide right here. This is bacon prices adjusted for inflation. As a common thing you'll hear is industry will justify this because it makes food cheap. That's not factually true anymore. So check out the bacon. So you'll notice before we industrialized hog production or late 80s, what bacon prices were. When Wall Street capital flooded into the hog markets in the 90s, you saw bacon prices, you know, go down. And then a lot of family farmers could not compete against Wall Street-backed industrial operations. So they exited the marketplace. They blamed themselves without realizing they were designed to fail. Then what's happened since then? Not only has bacon gone up, it's gone up more. Keep in mind, this bacon doesn't taste as good. old-fashioned bacon, hogs running around taste so much better than industrial hogs inside all day eating corn. So you're paying more for an inferior product. Here's this other chart. So back in the day, if you wanted the price fix, you hang out a Super 8 by the interstate. But now what companies do is they essentially share data. They use third-party data brokers. And in the meat industry, AgriStats is the common one people focus on, where here's this chart shows you all the different meat companies in the world, and they essentially aggregate the data. They de-identify it, but everyone kind of knows who's who in this space, and it really makes price fixing really easy. You might have heard about this in the news. Apartment landlords in big cities do this. And I love this chart right here. This, to me, is the nerdy version of a picture says 1,000 words. So this chart, the blue line is what consumers spend for beef at the store, and the red is what the cattle rancher gets. In 2015, up until 2015, they essentially were walking in tandem, and you see a divergence. And what the saddest thing here to me is actually early COVID, where you see a massive gap between the two. And that gap you see right there, that's the story of monopoly. So first of all, think of what rural Minnesota would be if that money was going back to those cattle ranchers instead of going off to these multinational corporations. My understanding is that gap has closed a little bit since then because essentially the collapse of the cattle herd in America, partly from climate change, but also because of these market forces. And finally, I love this little nugget because it says so much. McDonald's buys the most beef in the world. And usually most lines of business, you treat your largest customer the best way possible. McDonald's filed lawsuits against the Packers for price gouging. So you know things are bad when even McDonald's feel like it's getting shortchanged. I want to flag this story, this academic paper from a fellow Iowan, Kate Conlow, where what she highlights in this piece was we realized with the Great Recession, a lot of academics were taking money from banks and not disclosing it. And they were justifying what Bank of America wanted. And part of the response we did was we implemented disclosure policies. Hey, if you're going to publish scholarship paid for by Cargill, just disclose it. What Kate discovered, and she published this in the Arizona State Law Journal, was that a lot of these academics are not disclosing it. They're not even enforcing their own disclosure policies. So these are the people that go on NPR saying you're not being gouged at the store, even though they're taking money from the different companies. And to me, this really corrupts the academic sciences here. And finally, I want to slow this slide. I think a big undercurrent of all this is what is a farmer? On the right, it's a massive hog farmer in Iowa. He does 5 million hogs. That's his farm. To me, that looks like a suburban dentist clinic. If you know Des Moines, it's over by Jordan Creek Mall. So what is a farm? And then you look at the left. I mean, that I would argue Iowa has some of the best soil in the world, but to me, that looks like the New Jersey Turnpike. That land is dead. That money's being extracted from that community. And you're seeing a lot of that workforce, too, is largely undocumented. And finally, the system makes bad-tasting food. Inputs matter in meat and dairy production. My favorite example is Kerrygold butter. Kerrygold butter is Irish butter. Number two butter now in this country. People love it. It's bougie butter. Here's the thing. There's no difference between – the only difference between Irish butter and American butter is what we feed the cow. In Ireland, they feed them grass like we used to here. Most American butter is coming from Bakersfield, California. It's cows on a dirt lot eating ethanol byproduct. It makes a bad-tasting product. It's fibrous, so it doesn't spread well because of all the corn in the diet. It's white because it's not eating green grass. And people are all just kind of noticing that. So a few barons I want to talk about today. So JBS is my meatpacking baron. For Minnesota, one of the brands they own is Golden Plump. JBS, of all, I don't think people appreciate how wild this story is because it got lost in the 2020 election cycle. So the two brothers that built this company pled guilty to bribery. Now, I'm not talking campaign contributions. I'm talking they literally gave a Manhattan apartment to a Brazilian politician. They bribed over 1,800 Brazilian politicians to become the largest meat packer the world has ever seen. As part of their plea bargain, they agreed to wear a wire to bribe the president of Brazil. Here's the thing. The president was on he's the bottom left. He thought his house was haunted, so he was living at the vice president's house. So not only when this plea bargain came out, they allegedly did engage in insider trading on this plea bargain. I say this because this company, we've never seen a corporation this cartoonishly corrupt. They've been alleged to bribe meat inspectors. They've been alleged to hire children's slaughterhouses. the fact that they became a monopolist through bribery, we should think about unwinding their purchases, because it's not fair to American companies to compete against a company that became a monopolist through bribery. So they are number one in beef. They are number one in pork. They are number one in poultry, number two in pork, number one in leather. Just to give you a sense of their scale, check out these slides. These are all the different brands they own. This is slide 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8. You could be buying their product and not know. If you notice, their name's not on any of these products. Most people in Minnesota probably don't realize that Golden Plump is a secret Brazilian family. The one that got me is Cedar River Farms. So I'm from Cedar Rapids, Iowa. I was eating at this fancy restaurant in D.C. called Old Ebbitt Grill one time. And you know, like restaurants do, like, oh, our beef is coming from X person. I saw this on their menu, and I was like, oh, let me get this. Might be from where I'm from. Here's the thing. It's a fake local brand they have. You know, it's based in Greeley, Colorado, but it's exploiting the farmers doing it right. And on top of it, too, on the East Coast now and in Chicago, they're building these fake local meat stores. So they're exploiting the farmer trying to do something different. The Biden administration talked a big game about meatpacking, but the fact is not only did they not do anything, the meat markets have got more concentrated. I mainly put the blame on this at Secretary Tom Vilsack. I think of him as like, you know, the Music Man, the musical. He's like Harold Hill. He told you what you want to hear, but his words mean nothing. They kept giving USDA money to this company, even though it's been alleged to do all this stuff. Their theory of change here was, let's take $1 billion of taxpayer money, throw it at startups to deconcentrate a market. First of all, that has never worked in the history of this country. That's like taking $1 billion to ask Jeeves saying, good luck against Google. You're just lighting that money on fire. What you guys might have heard in the media on the bottom right was they financed a new chicken startup in Northeast Iowa. I think they had some operations here. It liquidated. There were literally stories in Iowa news saying, come get a free chicken. We don't know what to do. Not enough people came to get free chicken, so then the state of Iowa had to spend millions of dollars to kill all these chickens. Here's the thing. We know what to do here. We did this a century ago under Teddy Roosevelt. And on top of it, I mean, this is a bipartisan issue here of not making much progress, where Trump's largest inauguration donor was this family, JBS. And soon after they gave him $5 million, one of the first things they did was they spilled the kill lines for chicken. On top of it, right now, we're on the cusp of witnessing an existential moment for American cattle farmers. We're essentially flooding our beef markets with foreign beef, and especially from Brazil and Argentina. On top of it, the Trump administration is gutting the agency that oversees these markets and polices them, the Packyard and Stockyard Act. And finally, the brothers are now getting the eggs. Oh, on top, I mean, this shouldn't shock anyone, but they're also engaging in global and hiding their taxes abroad. Oh, I think this is an important point to make, too, especially as someone from Iowa. So we're producing more and more hogs every year, but as Americans, we're not eating more hogs. So we're essentially doing it for export. A lot of it's going to China. And so we got to ask ourselves, is it worth destroying rural communities to feed China? Because that's essentially what we're doing here. Iowa has 25 million hogs. They defecate 3 times more than us. That's the manure of 75 million people. That's the population of Texas and California combined with a regulatory agency that's been gutted. Simply put, Iowa has too much manure. The waterways are an open sewer at this point. So Cargill. Oh, man, to talk about Cargill here. Cargill, to me, is one of the most powerful things in the food system that no one knows anything about. I think they're the closest modern-day example we have in America to Standard Oil. It's all about, because it's all about owning the middle. They trade about 1 in 3, 1 in 4 grains globally. So let's take this from Cargill's own brochure to describe their power. We are the flour in your bread, the wheat in your noodles, the salt on your fries. We are the corn in your tortillas, the chocolate in your dessert, and the sweetener in your soft drink. We are the oil in your salad dressing, and the beef, pork, or chicken meat for dinner. We are the cotton in your clothing, the backing on your carpet, and the fertilizer in your field. First of all, that's phenomenal prose. Second, that is power. To put their power more in context, take all the state tax revenues of all the states in green, add them together, and you get what Cargill does. Part of this chapter here is talking about the history of the Farm Bill. The original Farm Bill comes out of the New Deal, or honestly, the farm crisis of the 1920s. But so much of the original Farm Bill was balance. You get a little this, you have to do a little that. Think of it like Goldilocks. You get some subsidies, but you have to essentially take land out of production. Cargill hated this. Cargill wants to move and process as much grain as possible. So you see a systematic assault on the Farm Bill. I focus on the 1996 one where it really goes off the rails, where now the Farm Bill is designed to overproduce grains. So if you grow carrots, you don't get anything. You grow corn, you get a ton of subsidies. And here's the thing. If you're a farmer and you're not growing corn and soy, you're going to go broke because that is what the system is designed to do. And you realize, like, to me, the best example of this Roth is actually crop insurance. It's not insurance. It's just a subsidy where 60% of your premium is paid for by taxpayers. What Congress realizes is large subsidies checks that look bad, so they designed a heavily subsidized insurance product. Here's the thing. There's also no cap on crop insurance. So fun little fact, Bill Gates owns some of the most farmland in this country. So Bill Gates can get as much insurance as he wants for crop insurance for corn. So what this does, keep this in mind, it makes healthy food expensive. On top of it, the best metric of how the system is failing farmers is this stat. For every dollar what Americans spend at the store, the farmer gets the lowest ever recorded in American history. It dances around like 11 or 14 cents. After these New Deal reforms, it was up to 52 cents. So first of all, imagine what rural America would be if 52 cents went back to the farmer. I mean, I privately view rural America at this point as an extraction colony. The land's producing the most wealth it's ever produced, and none of that's staying there. And those people are paying for the consequences of it. And so much of our obesity crisis is rooted in the system, because you realize the Farm Bill is designed for Pepsi. It's to make chips and pop cheap, so you need money now to be healthy in this country. And this, I love this photo because I asked a banker I know in Western Iowa about 2 years ago, why does every silo I see in Iowa falling apart? And she explained to me, the beauty of a family farm was it's like a retirement portfolio. You know, you have different things going on, different crops. So if one crop craters, at least you have other sources of income. What this Farm Bill does now is it essentially pushes people to do one or two things. You grow corn, you sell it to Cargill, Cargill sells it back to you as feed for industrial CAFO, and then you sell it back to Cargill. So first of all, it makes you very fragile. That's like putting all your money in Enron. All in one stock. And so that's why you see a lot of these silos collapsing in rural America, is because of this system pushing people to do one or two things. On top of it, the scary thing here is most corn and soy in the future will be robotics. And so you have to ask, what do you want rural America to be, with just a bunch of robots going back and forth? On top of it, this system pushes produce offshore because it's not being subsidized. So 40% of your veggies now, 60% of your fruit is now imported. By the way, that's why a lot of it tastes meh, because that strawberry comes from Argentina. It's not engineered for taste. It's engineered for durability. So you're paying more for like a meh-tasting produce. Also, keep in mind, farmers doing it right here, trying to grow veggies, you're not playing on a level playing field. There's been tons of documentation when produce moves to Mexico, they're using children, they're using chemicals they shouldn't. It's not fair to the farmers doing it here trying to do it right. So let's talk about ethanol. So this whole system, Econ 101 says if you overproduce, you grow something else. That's not what the system does. So every year is a record corn crop. But instead of, and as you notice, well, you know, animal feed's essentially flat. Other uses of corn is essentially flat. Is you come up with dumb things like ethanol. Anyone that thinks ethanol is good for the climate in 2026 thinks the world is flat. It's just a way to soak up surplus corn. And at this point, you can have ethanol or cheap food, but if you push ethanol, what you're doing is you're making food more expensive because you're taking the best farmland in this country and you're wasting it in your car. On top of it, look what happened. To me, Iowa's canary in the coal mine here. Iowa should be the Tuscany of North America, except now Iowa has a water crisis. 60 to 70% of the waterways in Iowa are an open sewer, has the second highest cancer rate, and has an obesity crisis. That's the consequences of this. This chart is from Des Moines, and it's also making the water very toxic. So like Des Moines, the top red line is EPA recommends that you keep the nitrates below 10. So when Des Moines takes in water in the spring, it shoots way above it. And people even think, scientists even think now we should lower it to 5. So just imagine, so first of all, cities are spending a lot of money to keep their water clean because of all these chemicals. But on top of it, imagine what this is for rural communities and their wells. As I mentioned earlier, Iowa is only one of two states with cancer rates increasing and the second highest cancer rate. And trust me, it's not because like Iowans are fake baking more or anything. And you also see an increase, the Washington Post did a story the other last year, how young people, they're seeing increased cancer rates in the Corn Belt. And the other thing here, too, to keep in mind is what's going on in the global soybean markets. Words have consequences. 10 years ago, when President Trump went after the whole soybean thing, what China did essentially was industrialize soy production in South America. And here's the thing. They can do two soy crops a year. Those markets are not coming back. And so we're facing gluts of our corn and soybean market. And it's like, it reminds me of the cartoon of Wile E. Coyote. It's like watching it run off a cliff right now because it's not coming. Like, we should be thinking about what's next, figuring out, especially as cars move to EVs, what's going to replace these markets. And finally, I close this chapter with, you know, earlier I said Cargill is kind of like Standard Oil. I think a better comparison for Cargill is like the 19th century British Empire. The sun never sets on their empire. They're still in Russia because you don't know who they are. And don't put their name on things. They don't feel like a need to, you know, get out of that market. And I think Putin's the best modern day example of a fascist. And on top of it, Colombia, there's a really good story in Financial Times from 10 years ago where, and partly in response, Colombia had a massive civil war, 250,000 people died. So what they did is they did land reform. They said one person can only own so much land. Oxfam discovered not only did Cargill exceed it, they exceeded it by 36 times. That is the scariest thing about Cargill. There's so much power that we know so little about because it's a privately traded company, privately held company. And I should note, they're the largest private company in America. They are bigger than the Koch brothers. So JAB, I just want to show this one really quick because this one usually tends to shock people. So this is a secret German family that up until 2012 did not sell a single bean of coffee in America. They now sell more coffee than Starbucks. They took their pot of money and they bought all these brands. So they bought like Minnesota's Caribou. In business, they call this a roll-up. They took their private money, they rolled it up, and the person being hurt here the most is a coffee farmer. Instead of having 20 buyers of your coffee, you have one. This chapter, I use this chapter to tell the story of antitrust law in America. So on top of it, when they bought those little Keurig cups, they also got all these Dr. Pepper brands. So that's what this family does, is they engage in monopoly play. The one a lot of people probably are feeling the impact of are actually vets. This family has bought over 1,500 local vet clinics because as awful as this sounds, they realize people are economically irrational with their pets. As I mentioned earlier, this chapter tells the history of antitrust laws in America. Fun little fact, the first anti-monopoly laws in the world came from Iowa. It was farmers mad about grain elevators. So they enacted a law, a few states copied, and eventually we did it nationwide. I tell the story of Louis Brandeis of so much the root of our antitrust laws in this country where we want to avoid concentrations of economic power because it corrupts the political system. Fast forward, Robert Bork unwound a lot of this, basically created a new framework where essentially it's pro-consolidation. And what's really interesting is President Biden appointed Lina Khan to chair the Federal Trade Commission and how uniquely bipartisan popular she was. You had Matt Gaetz praising her because her whole thing is let's go back to old-fashioned American antitrust. Let's go back to trust busting. You had Matt Gaetz praising her in the Wall Street Journal. You had Steve Bannon praising her. And I want to slow this slide because Kroger tried to buy Albertson grocery chain like a year or two ago. And it came out in hearings that, well, first of all, they would own all these brands. So all these grocery store chains you see on the right would have been one company. But what came out in the merger was it's real communities bearing the brunt of this the most. Those are the markets where they tend to have the highest market dominance. And so they were gouging those people the most. So think of it. The communities producing our food are paying the most for it. And finally, a big point of this chapter is monopolist finance fascism. After World War II, Congress commissioned a report, how did this happen? And that was one of their big findings. Hitler's largest donor was a company called IG Farben. It's a chemical company. Hitler would walk into a room saying, oh, I don't mean those crazy things. Let me help you sell product. After the war, we broke that company up. We broke it up into seven little companies. You might have heard of one of those companies. It's called Bayer Monsanto. As I mentioned, and just like Cargill, this company is still in Russia today. This company has a really, part of this chapter, I tell the story. They have a really dark past. They were early Nazi supporters. So kind of lay out this. So part of my book, too, is you have to understand how we got to this moment in order to fix things. And so for ideas to do is, honestly, the single best thing we could do, I recommend, is do a concentration study. What are the market shares? So these are national market figures for farmers. What's it like for Minnesota? What's the market share for beef packing in this country for dairy farmers? The data's out there. It's just about compiling it. Because here's the thing. We don't even know. You can't even talk about what to do if you don't know how bad the problem is. Second, I'm a big fan of structural rules. So there's this great piece of legislation that's been bounced around for 20 years in Congress by Chuck Grassley of Iowa and the late Paul Wellstone. It's called a packer ban, but essentially says meat packers cannot own the animals they slaughter. Iowa has a law in the books. We don't enforce it, but you essentially break up most meat companies because, like, fun little fact, the largest butcher of hogs in this country is the WH Group of China. They own Smithfield. They also own the most hogs. And you'd break them up with a simple rule that would ban that activity. The other thing, too, here is ban slotting fees. But people, so when you see, like, when you go down the grocery aisle, you see all those, like, pasta sauce options. Here's the thing. So much of that is pay to play. Because eye level is everything. I only know this because my dad used to be in the beer business, so he used to tell me all this stuff as a kid. But I remember a grocery store person telling me, you got to think of, like, a grocery store now as a mall without walls. The margins are so tight, so they make their money on this pay for play. The thing they keep, what's really scary here is it really prevents local companies from getting into the store. They can't get market access. The big boy will come in and buy up all the shelving space or the good space, so the little person can't get in. And this, a scary example here is, you know, Vizio, that TV company? Walmart bought it because that's another way to get at this. You buy, it's the same kind of logic here, where if you buy ads on Walmart TV, you get the good placement. My big thing, too, number four, is as ethanol slowly fades out, what are we going to do with all this land? I want to put animals back on the land. There's only so many cows on pasture one family farm can look after. Rural communities were healthy when we had middle-class family farms. It makes a better-tasting product. It's a jobs program. And we got to – that's – I mainly focus on dairy and hogs here, but that, to me, is – to me, one of the best things we can do for rural communities is in these industrial manure factories. And finally, institutional buyers. This one's given me a lot of hope. I'm actually working with Texas Maha people on this, where for the longest time we use what I call the carrot thing, where you put a little pot of money to buy local food. That really didn't work. I'm in what I call my stick era, where let's mandate that local colleges in the state buy local food. There's no reason why University of Minnesota, you're serving Brazilian rainforest beef. All beef served should be from Minnesota. Let's really use that to build up these supply chains. It's also a better tasting meal too, and you're helping keep your money locally. And this is an idea I've been toying with a lot because, like I mentioned earlier, Bill Gates owns a lot of farmland. As of this year, the Land Report reported that the Walmart family owns the most land in this country. They actually own more land than all the black farmers. They own more land than all the black farmers in this country combined. So they're the largest private employer. They own two NFL teams, the Chargers and the Broncos, and they own the most land. And here's the thing. You can tell when you drive county roads if it's an absentee owner or not, how they treat their land. And why I'm thinking about out of – because the class thing that happens here is grandma and grandpa die, kids move to L.A., they put into a trust, and they get all the subsidies, and they don't care for the land. So by looking at – is there a way to essentially create a different tax rate for people that actually farm their land? And finally, I want to end with this slide because what I really came to realize is the system we have now is radical. It is radical that one man owns 5 million hogs. So much of the reforms we're talking about are actually traditional. Putting animals on the land, that's very traditional. And so that's kind of what I'm focused on is people want hope right now. They want to see what the system could be. And I always – the joke I always – as I made earlier is Iowa should be the Tuscany, but is that kind of vision. That's what I think is – how we drive change here. So on that note, I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you so much for having me here today.
Thank you. Members, any questions? Representative Jacob.
Thank you for sharing your opinions. First thing I want to say is insulting my local farmers by saying that we're turning our waterways into sewers, that's a pretty tough pill to swallow. I certainly see farmers as being the solution to environmental problems, not the sole cause. I'm a corn and soy farmer myself, small corn and soy. Fourth generation myself. It's a very small farm. But I'm have you spent any time like in our local neighborhoods, or I'll say my neighborhood here in southeast Minnesota? Have you seen our farming operations? And
yeah, I'm from Iowa. I presented this book in 25 states.
Just go through the chair so you.
Oh, sorry.
Mr. Ferrick.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I'm from Iowa. I grew up in this. My parents keep a camper in northeast Iowa, or they did until recently. I presented this book in 25 different places. I mean, I actually kind of, I'm a believer you have to see this country to understand this country. And what I realize is these people, farmers like you, are actually bearing the highest cost of the system. You're paying for it with your well water, the cancer rates. And a lot of your kids don't want to live there because the cancer in the water. That's what's scary. And also, most corn and soy, these companies don't care about you. They're going to do robotics. And it's going to be done by robotics owned in like Miami.
Representative Jacob.
Thank you, Chair Hansen. First of all, I would invite you to come to my neighborhood in particular. So my farm, it's only 305 acres. But every farm up the road from me are still original family farms. One of them, the next farm up the road had been hogs converted to produce. The next farm up the road, small organic dairy. The next farm up the road, still small conventional dairy. The next farm, large dairy. But what I'm insinuating is having all those different options and providing services to the community, providing food to the community, in my view, perfect ecosystem, taking care of the environment, not doing what you're saying. We're the ones protecting the water, not the ones destroying the water. I just don't think, I think you're a long ways out of touch with the reality here.
Yeah.
I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Mr. Ferrick.
Nothing to add.
Representative Burkle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'll give you a little of my story. I am a turkey producer, and back in the day, we, as a group, bought a small plant in Thief River Falls, started a co-op marketing our own. I guess the question I'd have, if there's so much money to be made in the meat industry, and these big conglomerates are just cornering the markets, isn't there an opportunity for folks to do that? And why wouldn't small co-ops be springing up all over the country? And I'd like you to answer that in the context of the regulatory environment that processors work within, keeping in mind that those costs are borne by a process. If a co-op's got to follow the rules, right, gets expensive. And I can speak to that personally as chair of that board for years. So I'd like, just give me your perspective on that. If they're bailing money, why aren't there more small co-ops?
Mr. Ferrick.
No, I think that's a great question. What I've come to realize is the classic playbook they do is they capture the regulatory system and they push down regulations on the small. So essentially the barriers to entry are really hard. I mean, it's like the slotting fees. Why is Lay's paying for all the chip aisle at the grocery stores? They want to stop the local one from getting in. And so they put up regulatory hurdles to stop the local from making it. Or they'll do the capture thing, the classic thing like they did with hogs in the 90s, where they flood the money, the economy with money to drive out anything that's trying to essentially compete against them.
Representative Burkle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what you're saying is big plants don't follow HACCP rules or standard operating procedures at a plant or food safety training or antimicrobial testing. Or you're implying that big plants don't follow the rules.
No, what I'm saying,
Mr. Ferrick,
sorry, what I'm learning. What I'm saying is, what I actually heard a lot from like local farmers trying to make their own meatpacking plants is they have so much more regulatory hurdles to get over because they're not giving bribes to the president, really getting preferred access. But essentially, the big boys are locking out competitors. I mean, these companies are willing to play children. They're ruthless companies. To think that they're going to give you an ounce of market share is incredibly naive. They wouldn't bribe the president.
Representative Burkle.
I'll leave it that the group of 28, 25 growers that started our plant weren't naive when they started their plant in 1989. And they've competed against Cargill, and they've competed against Jennie-O at Hormel, and they've competed against Butterball. for 38 years and still are.
And still what?
And still are. So I guess I'll leave it at that. I think you have to, in the context of your charts, and we could roll back through charts, and you got a lot of crazy charts up here, but the Bacon chart in particular interested me. And just the fact that you're throwing a cost structure out there without any concept of what it costs to process and the regulatory environment we've created the last few decades. But beyond that, let me just, I'm glad you ended on the last slide here. Let's pick that apart for a minute. I'm curious how you, let's just read the last part. Sit down at a local restaurant, enjoy a meal where those who grew, picked, processed, transported, cooked, and served it all make a reasonable living at a fair price. And so in the context of your final slide, how do you define a fair price? Who defines it? What determines that? And is that measured from the perspective of the producer who picked it, the worker, the restaurant owner, the consumer? Who decides what the fair price is? How does that work?
Mr. Furr.
I mean, to your turkey point you made earlier, that's what we want. We want local companies thriving and doing well. The problem right now is most of them are going broke. To your question is, keep in mind, part of what's going on there is the two metrics I would point to is what the farmers are getting is the lowest ever recorded. So it shows that that's not working because you don't have bargaining power against these. But for the whole point of this right here is labor. Labor is bearing the burden of this. Like, I'm the beneficiary of a good meatpacking labor union. My grandpa used to work at Wilson's in Cedar Rapids. That used to be a middle class living in this country. You can buy a home. Now you have a lot of meatpacking workers who are being squeezed, making nothing, living in Section 8, two to a home. And at the benefit of a foreign multinational that's taking all that money and taking it out of these communities, out of this country. That's what this is trying to get at, is the average American deserves to make a decent living for working. That's what that point of that right there is.
Representative Burkle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But it still doesn't explain to me what that fair price is and how the economy would absorb it. Could you explain your background in economics? I don't have one, but I'm curious where yours is.
Mr. Furr.
So just a little example is I was speaking down southeast Minnesota, and I don't remember the town name, but I noticed when I got close to it last fall, I kept seeing cattle on the land. Like, I was like, oh, what's going on down here? This is really cool. And I realized there's a sale barn. Sale barn to me is like eBay. That is the best example for price discovery. You want competitive markets where a cow goes out there, people bid, you get a real price. What's happening in the meat industry now is these companies want people on forward contracts, mm-hmm. where you are essentially taking the price given. You do not know what other people are getting paid. And what that does is it really hurts farmers. So I actually think that's one of the best things to do right now is, how do we save sale barns? Because it's also on top of it, sale barns are a really good cultural thing. Mm-hmm. That's what I want to focus on. So my whole econ background, so I'm based at Yale. I used, in a whole different life, I used to be a treasury tax economist. So that's what actually got me into antitrust. Was 10 years ago, I did a paper on the growth of super rents in the U.S. corporate tax base, and I noticed that I was seeing it in food. And you're like, anyone can make chips. Why is one company having monopoly profit in chips? I met a young woman named Lena Khan who told me about all this. I'm like, oh, this explains what I saw in my lifetime. Why so many of these towns are in a state of decay, even though they're producing the most they've ever produced. So that's kind of how I got to doing this stuff.
Representative Burkle.
Thank you, Chair Hansen. I'm almost done here. I'm trying to get to the point of the fair pricing. Would a centralized body determine what fair prices are for labor, for cost of goods across the board? Who and how would a fair price be determined?
You maintain competitive markets so true price discovery can happen. And in the case of a beef farmer, you want to maintain sale barns because that allows true price discovery. Right now, you're having these markets being captured, and then you lose fair price or true price or whatever you want to call it.
Representative Burkle.
Yep. No, thank you, Chair Hansen. And I don't disagree with that. We have a small sales barn back home where I'm at. I think what I'm missing is your connection between that barn and the process, of getting that meat to the market the way the consumer wants it. And the way the consumer wants it today is cheap and uniform, and they want it when they want it, and they want it how they want it, and they want to pay what they want to pay. And what I've found personally as I've converted my farm to organic turkeys in the last 7 years, is there's a disconnect between what consumers really want to pay and what consumers really will pay and what their actions really are at the supermarket. And I think at some level there has to be some responsibility for the consumer to say, if we walk into a supermarket and we see, I'll use turkeys as an example. In a lot of cases we see at Thanksgiving, turkeys given away, right? $100, if you have a bill for $100 at the grocery store, you get a free turkey, right? Nobody's gonna buy my organic turkey if they can get a free turkey. So I think consumer choices are kind of driving a lot of what we're talking about here, and I think it's interesting that the consumer says they want this stuff, or you're telling me they do, but their actions say different. They want cheap, and they want plentiful, and they want it to, when they go to McDonald's, they want the French fries to look the same at every McDonald's they walk into. They want that uniformity. They want it to taste the same. So I'm not saying you're entirely wrong here on some of this stuff, but I think you're missing the big picture. The consumer really wants what they've got. That's what I would tell you.
Mr. Furr.
Yeah, I would just, I mean, it's clear consumer, first of all, one of the most bipartisan things right now is people not liking the food system. But they're like, I mean, the fact that Kerrygold's the number two butter, and that came out of nowhere, tells you how much people don't like normal butter in this country because of the production model. I don't really care for the consumer. Consumers don't really have an option when one company has a 60% market share in peanut butter. Because, like, so going back to the beer business, because my father, my dad always told me is, because of inequality, that yuppie consumer wants to think they're buying a different beer than the other one, but it's the same company. So like in the peanut butter case, they'll make the bougie peanut butter, but then they'll make the Dollar General peanut butter, but it's the same thing. My bigger concern is the peanut farmer, because I used to be 10 different buyers of peanut butter is one company. So all they did was price segment the market. And so for consumer choice, the consumer thinks they have a choice, like all those brands I showed you with JBS, but they don't realize it's the same company. So like you don't change systems with consumer choice. That's kind of the whole point of my book, is you need to change structures to change systems. Is these systems have been captured, and we're paying the consequences of it.
Representative Harder.
Sorry about that. Thank you, Chair Hansen. This is an interesting presentation. Why are you here? I mean, why did you come here to give this speech to agriculture? I'm just curious, really.
Oh, I mean, my sister lives nearby.
Mr. Furr.
Yeah. Got to see my sister. I got invited here today. I mean, this is – what I really enjoy doing this stuff is you see what the system could be. I saw what Iowa used to be in my lifetime. Iowa fell apart. It's sad driving this – what happened to my home. But you see the system that could be, and you just know we're at the end of a laissez-faire era, and these eras always come to an end. I don't want – and my book opens with a mad – administrative assistant who fights back. She told me we didn't get here overnight. We're not going to get there overnight. So that's why, I mean, I'm here today is, I mean, this book, I did not expect the reception it's gotten. I mean, I got invited to Brazil earlier this month. I'm going to London. Like, it's because people, I've been on Glimbeck's TV network. I've been in places I never in my life thought I would be. And like, to me, I'm also like, I'm very conscious of, I'm the American dream. I'm the child of a truck driver, home health aide. I get to do this at Yale. Like, this is pretty cool. But I also, to me, it shows you that it's kind of like the story of blind people touch an elephant. Everyone's describing something different, but it's the same thing. And that's what kind of excites me about this, is working towards what the system could be. I mean, I'm starting to work on my next book right now. I've been in Eau Claire a lot this fall. And like, I want to focus on the solution stuff. So that's why I'm here today, is the invitation, and I do what I do because I love what I do, and I'm very fortunate.
Representative Harder.
Thank you, Chair Hansen. Well, your presentation is, in my opinion, somewhat disparaging to the farming community. I myself am also a farmer, growing corn and soybeans. The corn that you made this comment that we grow corn and sell it to Cargill. Okay, we don't sell our corn to Cargill, just so you're aware of that. Every farmer does things differently. Our corn generally gets sold to the local chicken plant. Eggs, people enjoy eggs. And I really don't appreciate the work that I do on the farm day in and day out, with the exception of when I'm here, of being disparaged, that there is something wrong with agriculture. That's the way I took your presentation. There's something wrong with me being a farmer, feeding the world. That's important, because if we go away, where are you going to get your food? These are conversations that we do need to have, because we are moving so far away from people understanding how did we get here. I mean, the farm that I have, my grandparents bought it, or I should say my great-grandparents bought it. That's four generations. I mean, that is a legacy, and that's very important to me. But to sit here and to listen, you know, that I get my meat from a foreign country or whatever. I mean, my son works at a beef packing plant, and the cattle that they render, I mean, is from Minnesota. I mean, so it's local. Oftentimes when I buy meat, it's local. It's my local person. And you did ask the question, you know, what is a farmer? That was one of the questions you asked to begin with. And farming comes in so many different ways. It's those of us that work acreage, and I'm a small farmer. I'm not a large, elite corporate farmer that people seem to think that maybe I am because I own some acres. And it does get tiring to hear a lecture that somehow there's something wrong with being a farmer. There's nothing wrong with being a farmer. We built this. We, you know, worked hard. My great-grandparents did. I have a lot of family that's still in farming. My grandpa was a turkey producer. You really need to know your audience when you come here and to know how important agriculture is to our state. To many people, that I do know where my food comes from. And by the way, I do like Fairlife milk. It tastes good. And I don't care if it's $5 or $6 for a little container. I like it. I'm going to buy it. Other people buy it too. I don't really have a question. I'm just really disappointed that you come here amongst agriculture and just so disparaging, I mean, for the American farmer. I mean, I just hope that you take that to heart. Thank you.
Yeah, that's why I love that review from the American Conservative, praising how good my book is, because I really want you to have a fair price when you buy your corn seed and when you sell it. I would say if you really care about farmers, I hope you support putting animals back on the land, because that's one of the most pro-farmer things you can do. There's a lot of young people that want to farm, but they can't. That would allow them to. And if for the local meat, I really recommend working on getting then local beef served at the University of Minnesota and that kind of stuff. Thank you.
Representative Gottfried.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Furick, for bringing forth this presentation. And, you know, I will name it. I sense some of the tension in the room of you know, feeling attacked. And you know, I'll fully admit, I'm still learning more about agriculture, about farming. Something that I do know a little bit more about because of my past experiences is monopolization, oligarchies, and antitrust. Mm-hmm. And you know, I one of my takeaways from your presentation, at least the way that I interpreted it, and I understand the feelings of you know, my colleagues who have felt attacked here, but one of my takeaway wasn't necessarily that these were critiques of your farming operations or your 300-400 acre operations. My takeaway was that this was a critique of the operations that are run by JBS. By Cargill, by these massive, massive, massive conglomerates that have hundreds of thousands, if not millions of acres of land that they're extracting wealth from and bringing and not keeping it in those local communities. And sure, there were some statements that I think were made maybe with some broad generalizations without, you know, kind of the caveats that this isn't always the case. And that may be where some of these feelings are coming from. And I understand them. I do. But, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, and I'll turn it over to you in just a second, but my takeaway was that the thesis of this presentation was that if we do our due diligence to ensure that these massive, massive multinational conglomerates, these corporations, are kind of curtailed in a way to open up the market to smaller farmers, smaller producers, that collectively, both consumers and producers, smaller producers would benefit from it. And so before I go on, I just would, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. Frerich, but it was that kind of the central thesis of your presentation? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, that's the beauty of this, is you're putting more money back in the farmers' pockets that's been taken out of them. On top of it, you're not spending money on the government side. You're policing maintaining competitive markets.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Frerich. So, you know, I understand. I do understand. And there were a lot of, I'll say, harsh things said. There were. I think there is a lot of harsh criticism to be levied at specifically the companies that you have highlighted here. My background in antitrust, has taught me many of the dastardly tricks of the trade, so to speak, in that, you know, you'll buy up as much market share as you can. One of the things that they can then do if they have a outsized market share is artificially lower prices to drive out other competitors, then consolidate and then raise prices to an exorbitant level after having driven out local competition, after having driven out local farmers that do go about things the right way. And, I think it would behoove us all, in this committee to really think about, you know, how we may be able to reshape and utilize the tools that we have as a state to shape our market so it's better for those small farmers that do engage in those co-ops, like Representative Burkle was talking about, and create opportunities for us to have more of that circular economy where more of our dollars are kept here in state in the incredibly proud tradition of farming that I know all of us at this table value here, this very long oval horseshoe-shaped table. So I would encourage all of us to look at things that we can, and I will end with this. I'm sorry, this is more pontificating than anything, and I do apologize for that, members. But I would encourage us all to kind of keep this in mind. I think what this has proved, a lot of the statistics that are borne out. There's a lot quoted here, but there's a lot borne out, and there is a lot of information covered very quickly. But if you dive deep, you will see that our supposed free market isn't free. That consolidation, corporate capture of specifically these massive, massive, massive corporations have made it harder on consumers, have reduced consumer choice, have reduced opportunities for smaller farmers, like those of us that are sitting, like those of you that are sitting at this table. And we need to do the work to correct that. And there are things that we can do as a state to put more power into the hands of small, of medium-sized farmers, of family farms, and take it out of the hands of massive, massive corporations that don't care about our communities. Like, I know every single person at this table does. And so, I know there were some harsh things said. I know there were some, feelings that there was disparagement. And I truly understand where those feelings are coming from. But I would also encourage all of us to take this information here and see that we can do so much better for our small and local farmers by help shaping the market to be more conducive to those small and local farmers here. And I do think some of the ideas, these last six ideas at the back end of that, are a way for us to correct the market so that we can do just that and keep Minnesota dollars in Minnesota, keep Minnesota food in Minnesota, feeding Minnesotans, and in a virtuous cycle. So I have rambled on long enough, and I will just thank everyone in this room today for being a part of this presentation and this discussion. Thank you, Mr. Frerich. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Frerich.
Nothing to add.
Representative Vang.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Frerich, for being here today. I think this conversation that we're having today is actually very much needed. It's also refreshing because I think Chair Hansen and I are now considered one of the more veteran members of this committee, and this is probably the more eye-opening conversations that we needed to have for a very long time. And I don't think that there should be any hard feelings for having this type of conversation. I think, Mr. Ferrick, I understand your thesis very well, this book. Corporations are not paying the farmer their fair share. That's simply the argument. And thank you for highlighting that and making sure that we are holding corporations accountable to consumers like farmers who's, and to us. They're getting away with this. I mean, I'm sure we remember the times of COVID where JBS in Worthington created bottlenecks in our food system, and farmers have had to depopulate thousands of hogs, not at their fault, their own. And who came to the rescue? The state did, to help the farmers depopulate. It came out of our pockets, not the corporations. And workers suffered at JBS during COVID. And we paid for the PPE and companies' loans to afford those. And so I think we should all be angry at corporations taking advantage of our goodwill to protect the farmers, and farmers not getting their fair share. Talk about, you know, the grain indemnity fund that we've been talked about, talking over the number of years, where these elevators simply just go bankrupt and then the grain indemnity just pays the farmers. But who's accountable? Nobody's held accountable. And so I think this is a very much needed conversation that it's not about blaming one on us or blaming the farmer. It's about us. We've been doing the work. We've been doing good work, and we're not paying. We're not getting paid for that good work. Farmers are getting taken advantage of that. They're getting signed into contracts with corporations like JBS. JBS doesn't have to pay them for the land, or their rent, or their equipment, or their animals. They just put them in these contracts where farmers have to take care of everything, and the corporations just profit off of that. And so I think as we look into how can we continue to support farmers and our agricultural lands, continue to make sure that the next generation of farmers can afford to be a farmer, that we look at this growing consolidation. And we're seeing this, I feel like we need to learn lessons in agriculture, the consolidation of rural farms, of corporations, and we're seeing that now in healthcare, where hospitals are shutting down. Because, and they have to consolidate, they have to get bigger in order to, I guess, provide healthcare. And so I think that this is something that we need to learn our lessons from very quickly. And thank you, Mr. Ferrick, for teaching us those lessons, telling us what we need to do. I guess one question that I have for you will be, what do you think are some low-hanging fruit or not? Yeah. At this moment, what do you think are some low-hanging fruit that we can do at this state in the short term to continue to address this issue?
Mr. Ferrick.
Two things that come to my mind is actually hire more antitrust attorneys in the AG's office. Those are basically cops on the beat here looking and investigating this. My knowledge is there are 7 currently in the AG's office who look at antitrust. The second one is really just do a concentration study. Just know how many options do these different type of farmers in Minnesota have? We just don't know. I mean, cause like you're not, when we talk about this, we use national, and like, you're not going to take a cattle from here and sell it in Maine. So why are we using national data? And just add on 2 points to what you said is one, just add on to those contract bit. people need to keep in mind these contracts are derived from sharecropping that was really exploited to black farmers. And we're essentially doing that to most animal farmers in this country at this point. And second, what I really have ingrained and come strongly believe at this point is ethanol is making food more expensive, especially if people push aviation fuel. What you're essentially doing is you're taking land out of production and you're making Americans pay more for food. That is what you're doing when you're pushing that kind of stuff.
Representative Vang. Representative Agbaji.
Thank you, Chair Hansen. Thank you, Mr. Farrick. Your book sounds quite fascinating and parallels a lot of consolidation that we've been seeing in other markets, as Representative Vang talked about. The one I'm more familiar with is kind of housing, you know, and the land that's being taken up and the homes that are being bought by these huge corporations. I know there's some parallels in the agriculture space, too, of, you know, who owns the land, and you talked a lot about that in your presentation. So kind of along those lines with land acquisition, what are some of the interventions that you've seen to kind of help break up those large land purchases to see if we can make more land available to those smaller mid-sized farmers?
Mr. Furt.
Oh, I think that's one of the biggest black boxes right now, even just to do a study on that. We don't know who owns what because of the LLC structures. That's why that land report's interesting is they essentially, these researchers, we randomly discover that Walmart family owns all this land. You know, I mean, they didn't do that overnight, but there's so many unknowns here. What I go back to is there was a story a few years ago in the Des Moines Register that most farmland in Iowa is owned by non-Iowans now. It's these absentee owners. And then what it does is when you can't beat Wall Street money. You know what I mean? And the average farmer can't compete on price against this Wall Street back, you know, acquisition. And so just even knowing how bad the problem is, I think is huge. I'm interested in a tax rate of higher tax rates for non-owners or absentee owners, just because of how do you essentially, we want to get back to a point that those who work the land actually own the land. Cause it's just like they just care for it more.
Yes. And then another aspect of your presentation that stood out to me too is you were saying that there were higher rates of cancer in these areas where these large corporations are essentially just messing with the water. And so I'm wondering if your research or if you know of other researchers picked up kind of like actually which cancers those might be. Because the other thing that's also in the news now is a lot of young people are getting colorectal cancer. And so I don't know if that's related or if they're seeing correlations. But there's just a lot more cancers that usually have come up when people are older that are now showing up in people who are younger. And just wondering if you saw any correlation in that.
Mr. Furrick.
I do not know which cancers in particular off the top of my head. What generally has happened is a lot of this is coming from ethanol because essentially a lot of people are taking – this whole system is about maximizing your yields on your acre. So people take out their buffer strips. So most of this water pollution, it's actually coming from the chemicals used in corn and soy production. So a lot of the people – because you have to – the margins are really tight right now, so you have to plant as much as you can. You take out the buffer strip. You plant right up to the creek. Anyone who drives rural America, you'll notice it. Like you'll just see the corn right next to the creek. The chemicals go straight into the waterway, and that, some argued, is helping drive this cancer crisis, is this exposure to these chemicals. I wish I knew which cancer it was, but I can follow up on that.
Representative Abadji.
Thank you, Chair Hansen, and thank you, Mr. Farrick, for your presentation. I think overall it just goes to show that we have corporations in every aspect of our society. They are continuing to extract from us. I think it actually really behooves us to ask these questions, particularly for those of us who are business owners or small farmers in this space. We're getting taken advantage of by folks who only want to make sure that they can extract as much dollars out of us as they can. And I would hope that this is actually a starting point for conversation of kind of how can we make sure that our food supply in Minnesota, our farmers in Minnesota are actually the ones who are reaping the benefit of what they do. And I know that there's many good ideas to do that. And I think Minnesota is kind of one of those places right now that maybe we may still be kind of at the precipice of all of these corporations coming in and kind of, you know, laying the groundwork that they've done in other states. And we have an opportunity to kind of push back on that. And I hope that we can work together.
Mr. Furr.
Yeah, I would just add, local businesses are what make a place a place. They have pride. Like, no one opens a restaurant to make money. They do it because they love it. And you always feel it when you go into a local restaurant, that sense of dignity. And so much of this economy is devoid of that. And I saw that with my mom. My mom used to own her coffee shop, and then she worked for a Starbucks. And just the lack of agency she had over her job really impacted her.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Chair Hansen. And I want to thank you for this presentation today. There was a lot of information. And as I look around the table here and around the room, you know, I see quite a variety of people that are involved in the food system. There's a couple, you know, several of us, myself, I'm a farmer. I see some in the audience, I see a vegetable farmer that does a lot of direct marketing and someone that's wanting to be, aspiring to be, do that. And, you know, there's quite a broad spectrum of it. And when I see a presentation like this, I mean, yes, it is highlighting some big glaring things in our system. And I think we also have to take a look at how we've gotten here. And this has taken a long time. Think back to Mr. McCormick designing a threshing machine and simply cutting grain. Whereas, you know, what Mr. McCormick started in the 1800s, yes, it's owned by Fiat now. You know, it's and that's where it's gotten to. But what he designed to make, at that time there was, in the 1800s, the majority of the United States was involved directly in agriculture. I think it was close to 90%, if I remember right. You know, it was many. Now we're at about 1%. And, you know, I think a lot of these shifts that of where it's gone to, it's made it so that someone like me can farm a lot of acres. I can go home and I can plant 300 acres in an afternoon of corn. I can do that. But at the same time, I also try to direct market beef. Most of mine, it actually goes on to a feedlot, and it probably goes to JBS or Cargill. I don't know. I sell mine as calves, and somebody else raises it from there. But when I look at direct marketing, you know, and the challenges of that brings, having a custom processor. You know, there used to be a locker plant in every town, and those have gone away. Well, the customer has also changed. It used to be no big deal to be able to sell a full beef to a family because there were seven kids in the family, and a full beef might have lasted a couple of months, while a full beef now today might last the family of four a year or more. And so now they want a quarter beef or maybe an eighth of a beef, or they might want to buy just direct cuts. Well, now if I'm selling a direct cuts and everybody wants ribeyes, well, there's only so many ribeyes in a steer. And, you know, and so teaching, you know, our consumer has changed. They don't know what to do with the whole animal anymore. Cooking has changed. There's so much with this. And I think I hear some of the frustrations of my colleagues here, and we do feel attacked. And I think that it's easy to feel that way, but I think one of the problems with a presentation like this is it's taken hundreds of years to get to where we are today. And yes, there's consolidation. And what was the dream of Mr. McCormick 170 years ago to create a machine that would be able to harvest an acre of small grain faster is now part of a big corporation. And I can buy, you know, that same machine that it's obviously 170 years newer in technology, but the people in that factory want to get a fair wage. Everybody wants a fair wage along the way. And, you know, what is that reasonable thing? And unfortunately, it's a small group of people that ends up, you know, the minority usually ends up feeling the pressure of where that fair wage is. And so in agriculture, we're getting squeezed on that. And I think there was a lot of important things that were highlighted in this, but a presentation like this, unfortunately, takes an extremely complex uh, extremely complex issue and tries to boil it down into something that's very simple and say all we need to do is antitrust and it'll be fixed. Well, that's not that there isn't antitrust things that need to happen, but we've taken an extremely, and we've just taken, you know, one layer of an onion off of this and said, well, this is the problem. Well, no, it's there's a whole lot involved in this, and every one of us, whether we like it or not, enjoy facets of where we've gotten to today. We might like buying the produce from the roadside stand, heirloom tomatoes or wherever, but you know those heirloom tomatoes are not. Well, they taste great, but they also don't work well in our grocery stores. You know, they crack easy. They do whatever, and so there's a lot that's gotten to be where we are, and you know, to be able to continue to support the 99% of people that don't live on a farm is why we've gotten to where we are. And I know that there's people that want to come back to the farm, and there's a lot of hurdles with that. It's a huge capital investment to be able to do that, and it's I think this, you know, overall, I think this presentation highlights some issues, but I don't think that it really captures what, you know, where we're at and where it's going, because it's really trying to make a extremely complex situation too simple. And it's, you know, we can't do that in an hour and a half. We'd have to have a few more weeks, and we don't have that time. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'll conclude my comments.
Mr. Furick.
Yeah, I would just say I always lead with antitrust because I don't think you can solve anything until you bring in the oligarchs. When a brother is willing to essentially, a company that's willing to employ children, you're not going to, they're ruthless. And so you can't make meaningful reforms as long as they're that powerful. And they're willing to essentially behave in ways most other corporations are not willing to behave. And the second point, I just want to note, what I've been most proud of is how receptive this book has been to the cattle ranch community. The American Grass-Fed Association president endorsed my book, and I was very fortunate to keynote our calf convention this past summer. Is because more of any farmer right now, I actually think the one most bipartisan thing right now is to help the cattle rancher. Because they're really being squeezed. And like that, it's an existential moment for the cattle ranchers because we're essentially seeing the offshoring of our beef supply.
So I'm just going to go to Representative Anderson for close, but so Representative Lawrence.
Thank you, Mr. Chair Hansen, and thank you to our guests for being here today. I am very grateful that I had a chance to be raised in an agricultural family and to experience a lot of the experience I had as a young person growing up in agriculture. I'm also glad that I get to sit on this committee and have some lively discussions. I think some of the things that definitely are brought to light today is we as people on the Ag Committee and representing our cities and our communities, our counties, and the people in our state, we have tremendous opportunity today. We have opportunity to choose organic foods if we want to have organic foods. We have an opportunity to stop by a roadside stand, go to a local garden, and support those areas there. We also have large farming, right, that feeds a whole different segment of society and meets a whole lot of other different demands. And Minnesota's always been a very unique place, very agriculturally focused, agriculturally minded. I think of we've got a baseball field named after a big cooperative, C.H. Field, right? We've got roadways named after a big agricultural family named the Pillsbury's, right? We've got Cargill as a family-based business here as well. And I share some of the, and I don't want to forget Kemp's. You know, we've got milk drinkers in the place. We've got dairy farmers, right? And Kemp's as well. We've got some huge agricultural businesses that I'm going to take one step further, because a lot of times we feel like we're pointing the finger a little bit, and we as representatives, we sit on many different committees, talk to a lot of different. There are thousands of families that are employed in these industries as well that go to work every day in one of these segments, fulfill a role, work in marketing, work in purchasing, work in accounting for these companies that go back to our districts and live and eat, live, use agricultural commodities as well. And so as we walk down this path, let's not forget that these companies serve a huge purpose for our state as well, huge economic. And provide many, many families and individuals with an income source, an employment place where they enjoy being a part of as well. And so you brought up a lot of great subjects to discuss. There's no question about that. A lot of interesting things and ways to take and look at it. But we have a much bigger picture, much bigger industry to consider and to look at the people of our state and how they're cared for in the future as well. So thank you. Just a comment.
Mr. Furr.
Yeah, thank you. I would just add, I can't say this enough. There is an illusion of choice. People don't really have a choice anymore in most of these markets. And the second, Minnesotans will earn more when you make these markets competitive. That way you can bop around and see who's going to pay you more. When there's only one company buying your labor, they call this a monopsony, is you're essentially dictated the wage. So the beauty of enforcing competition in the markets is people will earn more money.
Co-Chair Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and this has been a lively discussion. I admire you, the testifier, coming up into Minnesota, the home of some of the biggest ag companies in the world. Cargill's been mentioned. We have CHS, the largest ag cooperative in the United States, the Land O'Lakes. And, yeah, this discussion could go on for a lot longer. You raised some points. Some of your points I disagree with, some very much I disagree with. We have a buffer law in this state. We do not spray rot down to the edge of buffers, edge of ditches. We have buffers. And you said ranchers are being squeezed right now. My goodness, the one bright spot in agriculture is the cattle, cow-calf operations. And they are the ones that are enjoying record high prices now. I especially disagree. I must be a flat earther. Your comments on ethanol. You said corn is making our food more expensive. My goodness, the price of corn today is bargain basement. It's under the cost of production. And to say that is causing food prices to go up, I totally disagree with that statement. And, ethanol, sustainable aviation fuel. Europe is begging for sustainable fuel. In Minnesota, just got some numbers. We pumped about 14 million gallons of E15 in Minnesota. The average savings of 14 cents a gallon, which saved Minnesota consumers about $20 million just last year. And again, we could go on about this. And I just want to close, Mr. Chair, in saying this. You're talking about these big companies, foreign companies. I'm not going to say the name of the company, but this is what they're doing in a small town here in Minnesota. Their payroll is $100 million. They paid the growers $30 million. They offer tuition-free community college to the employees. It's funded $200,000 to mentor children. It's $100,000 to improve a neighborhood hockey rink and $40,000 to put turf on a high school football field. I think our larger companies can be good neighbors, and we work with them, and they perform a service that, I wouldn't want a small company over in the Strait of Hormuz today trying to source fertilizer. It takes a big company that can manage the risks, pay the insurance to get a load of fertilizer through the dangerous areas, and we need some of these companies, and the discussion will go on. But I think you can understand some of the frustrations we feel, Mr. Chair. My member spoke very well and understand what's coming from your side as well, too. But again, we need all kinds of agriculture. And to feed the world, we need Minnesota's powerhouse of agriculture to help feed the world. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Farrick.
Yeah, I think your point on ranching is a really good point to bring up. Beef prices are at record high now, but what's really scary is usually at these moments in history, we see a rebuilding of the herd, and we are not seeing that. Because cattle farmers have learned, they've been conditioned that these packers are squeezing them, so they're not rebuilding the herds. On top of it, cattle ranchers are being hit by ethanol, because what the ethanol did is we expanded corn production, we pushed animals off the land. Cattle ranchers can't compete on price against ethanol. On top of it, because of the climate crisis, a lot of the cattle land in the South we can't do in production anymore. So our ranch land is shrinking. That's what's really scary is, that's why I'm talking about the offshoring of the beef supply system. It's because we're not rebuilding the herd. And now, on top of it, these cattle farmers can't compete on price against rainforest beef that has been alleged to have slavery used in its production model. And to your point on ethanol, I just refer to basic econ 101. You have 100 acres, you can grow food, or you can waste it in your car. But you have to pick one. And if you pick the waste in your car, you're going to make food prices go up because you're not growing food. Thank you.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. You're forgetting one thing. In the production of ethanol, two-thirds of that comes back to feed cattle, livestock. One-third goes to the fuel production. So when you say 100 acres all goes to fuel, that's not correct. About 33 acres would go to fuel.
Mr. Furick.
Yeah, it goes to making really bad butter. That's what most corn industrial cows are fed in Bakersfield, California. Let's think about how illogical that is. To take cows in a desert that get less than 10 inches of rain, you truck in feed, you drain the aquifers, and you make a bad product. Let's go back to the old way butter used to be produced, where butter makes sense here. You have a good climate. Do that. The industry will always justify this weird byproduct, but it's used in a pretty lackluster way.
We do have one bill on the calendar. Before we go to that, I just want to make a couple comments. I've sat on this committee for 22 years, and a comment that always usually comes up, well, always people react to their own personal experience. We always use our own personal experience. I can use my personal experience. I think you've heard me give that speech before. But a diversified economy is possible if we have diversification of thought. And that means we have different opinions. And so often here, we're presented with a monopoly that all ag must speak with one voice, all ag speaks together, ag has some outside force that it needs to defend itself against. And what will we be afraid of with having that thought, having different thoughts, having different perspectives? And Representative Nelson, you're absolutely right. We didn't get here overnight. This is, you know, when I look at those sheets that show one company owning all those brands, and you think you're buying a brand, and it's not. It's been sold off. And so I think price transparency, but also ownership transparency is important. And there's a menu of choices. I think we're on a point where we all have our own personal experiences. We have our own personal experiences, and then we have our communities that we represent, and they're all different. And so if we can actually find some things that can get to a place where we're providing support for all of Minnesota, that's going to take a diversity of thought, a diversity of ideas, a diversity of agriculture, a diversity of markets, because that's the world we're in. We have to have these different options, and some may not work. Some will fail, some are gonna be tested, but some are gonna work, because the monopolies are working against us. They're working for profit. And yes, we have Minnesota companies here that do great work and have lots of employees, but to have a diversified economy that works for everybody, whether you're the laborer, whether you're packing or hauling or transporting or eating, you know, we have to be more creative than we are. We can't just do what we've done. It's a different world. So thank you for being
here.
Thank you. We will have up Representative Anderson, Co-Chair Anderson, House File 3718, Provisions Relating to the Practice of Veterinary Medicine and the Veterinary Technology Modified. We have two testifiers, and we are holding this bill over because I think there's a fiscal note coming.
Thank you.
It'll probably arrive about 10 minutes after we adjourn, but we know there's one coming. Mr. Savory, has it arrived yet or not?
I think, Mr. Chair, if the committee were to act favorably on the A1 amendment, we would updated request, so
okay.
That may be something to consider down the line as we take up the amendment.
Representative Anderson, do you want to move your bill?
Mr. Chair, yes. I'd like to move House File 3718 before the committee.
And then you have the A1 amendment?
Yeah, I do. I'd like to move the A1. And members, as amendments go, there's a lot of things in the amendment, and I think that goes to show that there's been a lot of work put into this bill. And the bill itself is fairly lengthy, and the amendment marks a lot of people working together to hopefully come up with a product that's close to a final product that we can move ahead and to really modernize some of the standards in the veterinary industry. So I'd move the A1, Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson moves the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape he would like. Is there any questions for Representative Anderson? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Ayes have it. The amendment is adopted. Co-Chair Anderson to the bill as amended.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And in the interest of time, I'm going to turn things over to the experts here to talk us through the bill and tell us what it does.
Dr. Johnson, welcome.
Thank you, Chair Hansen.
What's your name for the record?
Good morning, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dr. Pam Johnson. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Veterinary Medicine. I previously practiced equine ambulatory medicine in the state of Minnesota, and I currently serve as a colonel in the U.S. Army Reserve Veterinary Corps. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to be here today to testify on House File 3718, a bill modernizing languages in the Veterinary Practice Act. So Chapter 156 establishes Minnesota regulatory structure for veterinary medicine, licensing, drug control, facility inspections, and discipline. The bill represents a comprehensive modernization, expanding definitions, updating licensing systems, formalizing telemedicine, and adding new regulatory categories. The bill broadens statutory definitions, adding key terms such as client, consent, emergency stabilization, telemedicine, teletriage, physical rehabilitation, veterinary specialist, veterinary technologists, and others. The bill expands the board from a 7-member to a 9-member board, adding a licensed veterinary technician seat and an additional veterinarian or technician flex seat. The bill adds new requirements for veterinary technicians for continuing education, humane care, pharmaceutical handling, record keeping requirements, and discipline grounds specific to technicians. These regulations are necessary to add to the Practice Act before veterinary technician license begins in July 1st of this year. The bill adds more defined remote supervision authority and broader permission for livestock management tasks. It replaces and expands the definition of veterinary practice to include behavioral and dental care, complementary or integrative therapies such as acupuncture, chiropractic type modalities, and homeopathy. It defines clear authority for telemedicine, requiring a veterinary client-patient relationship except for emergency stabilization and teletriage situations. It provides more detailed allowance for reproductive procedures and treatment categories. The bill updates veterinary drug definitions and processes to align with federal law and repeals several outdated provisions, such as older definitions, temporary permit section, and certain drug rules. It's consolidating some of those and updating them into a more cohesive section. The bill also establishes a prescription repository program for animal prescriptions. It was developed in consultation with the Board of Pharmacy, and the program is modeled after the Human Prescription Repository Program enacted in 2019. It allows individuals to donate unused pet medications for redistribution in accordance with applicable safety and regulatory standards. As veterinary costs continue to rise, the program may help reduce financial burdens for pet owners while minimizing medication waste. Although the board has planned to address gaps in the regulation for equine teeth floating and routine facility inspections, it will continue to collaborate with stakeholders to refine the proposals and anticipate returning to the legislative process sometime in the future. I thank you again for the opportunity to be heard, and I'm happy to answer any questions from the committee or the chair.
Members, any questions for Dr. Johnson? We do have testimony. There's written testimony in your packet. And then we have Brittany Johnson from Minnesota Farmers Union via Zoom. Welcome and state your name for the record.
Hi, everyone. Thank you, Chair Hansen and members of the committee. My name is Brittany Johnson, and on behalf of myself and Minnesota Farmers Union, I am glad to share my strongest support for Co-Chair Anderson's bill to further clarify the legislature's work to allow an expanded scope of practice for veterinary technicians. I am grateful for the opportunity to testify over Zoom since I live in far northwest Minnesota and I'm currently smack dab in the middle of lambing season. So, yes, very appreciative. This bill is important to me because I have been experiencing the shortage of large animal veterinary care on my farm. I started farming in 2017 with a flock of sheep and a flock of chickens. We direct market our products and we sell any unsold lambs at our local sale barn. The first situation early on in my farming career that caused the shortage to hit home was a case of fly strike in a ram lamb that had broken a horn. I had called multiple veterinarians for assistance and none of them were available to help me treat this poor guy. And they recommended that I transport him to a clinic an hour away. That can be a huge challenge for farmers like me who work full time and maintain off-farm jobs. And so I did what farmers have always done, and I phoned a friend who helped me manage my way through the issue. But you know, just starting out farming, I would have really preferred an on-site examination for my lamb and a recommended treatment. The second time that this hit home for me was when I was attempting to achieve an OPP-free certification through the Minnesota Board of Animal Health. OPP is a chronic viral wasting disease of sheep, and being OPP-free certified improves your flock biosecurity, and it increases the price that I'm able to charge for my lambs. However, my veterinarian is at capacity and didn't have the ability to assist me with taking blood samples, which is something that I've never done before. It's something I don't feel comfortable doing by myself at the moment. So I'm not able to join the program, even though I'm interested in it, and it offers so many benefits. And I know from working with farmers in my role as an outreach coordinator for Minnesota Farmers Union and for my network that I am not the only one with this experience. I know many cattle producers who have veterinarians coming from 2 hours away, and a good friend of mine actually just had to sell her horses because her local equine vet was at capacity and didn't have the ability to take on new patients. So much like farmers, veterinarians are retiring and there aren't folks there to replace them. And increasingly, we are required to rely on their expertise for handling certain medications. And so this has consequences not just for farmers, but also for livestock shows, for 4-H events, for sale barn auctions, and all the other events where a veterinarian is required to be present. So allowing an expanded scope of practice for veterinary technicians would help address the shortage and help farms like mine be successful. And, you know, the worst days on my farm are the ones that involve triaging sick animals. And so I am really grateful to the committee for your work on this issue, and I am happy to answer any questions.
Members, any questions? Thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify for or against the bill? Any questions from members? Co-Chair Anderson, any closing comments?
Mr. Chair, members, thank you for hearing the bill. Thanks for the testimony. I mentioned I'm excited that the vet technician program is going to launch on July 1st of this year, and we really need more people in the field, especially in the area of large animals. I met this morning with the veterinarian folks and heard some of the obstacles they have in terms of having enough people out there. You know, it's an expensive way to get through college, the university program, and you know, you can go large animals or small animals, and And it's a decision they have to make. But we really need more veterinarians, and especially large animal vets in rural Minnesota. So with that, Mr. Chair, I would recommend that House File 3718, as amended, be laid over. Well, I didn't think we'd finish this quickly after our discussion this morning, but very respectful discussion and interesting. Yeah, I think it shows that there's a lot of different facets of agriculture, and I think for the most part this committee has worked pretty well together, working with you, Mr. Chair, and we've done some good work. So thanks to all of you.
Thank you, Co-Chair Anderson. I think we have done good work, and you know, we're kind of waiting to see what some of the fiscal questions are, like on this bill. If there's a fiscal note, I would hope that if there isn't any, we can move that out and try to make some law. So thank you, Co-Chair Anderson. With that, we are adjourned.